Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, in the American state of California, prisoners are usually able to get out of jail before their sentence is completed. Some prisoners win a conditional or temporary release from jail through acts of kindness or by doing good things. Others are approved for release after showing a change in behavior, like becoming a religious leader or advising others against drug use. But for Walter Erlon Woods, the path to freedom was a podcast. Woods was released from the San Quentin State Prison after serving 21 years of a 31-year jail sentence for attempted armed robbery. Last November, California Governor Jerry Brown canceled his sentence. Brown noted Woods' leadership in helping other prisoners and his work on Ear Hustle, a podcast in which he talks about everyday life inside the prison. The show has been very successful since it was launched in 2017. It has been downloaded 20 million times by people all over the world. On the program, Erlon Woods and Nigel Poor, a prison volunteer, talk with San Quentin prisoners about their struggles. Some prisoners talk about the difficulty of sharing a 1.5 meter by 3 meter room with another person. Others tell why they take care of frogs or insects as if they were household pets. Some describe the effects of solitary confinement or being given a death sentence. Woods helps listeners understand prison life. Poor is a San Francisco Bay Area artist who has volunteered at San Quentin since 2011. She asks thoughtful questions that sometimes lead prisoners to seriously consider what put them in prison. Wood said the podcast offers listeners a closer look into lives most people do not spend much time thinking about. People get to see the car chases, they get to see the trial, but they don't know what happens after you get to prison, Wood said. We've been able to really humanize people, and people realize that those in prison are just people who made dumb decisions. Jerry Brown agreed. In the letter issued to end his sentence, the now former governor wrote that Woods has clearly shown that he is no longer the man he was when he committed this crime. The podcast project started after Poor contacted Woods. In 2016, Poor heard about a podcast talent competition. She asked San Quentin's spokesman, Sam Robinson, for permission to enter the prison. Another co-creator, Antoine Williams, agreed to do sound design for the project. Williams is serving 15 years for armed robbery. Poor said their idea for a podcast from San Quentin beat more than 1,500 other proposals from 53 countries and received support from a group of broadcasters. She added, "Everyone was shocked when we won, especially the prison." Ear Hustle has found international success. Listeners send cards and letters from as far away as New Zealand, Qatar, and Mauritius. The free show can be heard in prisons throughout California and Britain. One program talked about Woods' first day as a free man. The first thing Woods did after his release on November 30th was get a look at the Pacific Ocean around San Francisco Bay. It looked, in his words, as far as the eye can see. New Ear Hustle shows will be released later this year. They will include stories of Woods' life outside of prison. The show will also have discussions with other prisoners released after long sentences. Woods and Poor plan to visit maximum security jails and tell the stories of their prisoners. "There's a lot of people that's in there that should be out," Woods said. "I created a podcast, but I'm not the exception."
Jin Park is the first dreamer from the United States to win a Rhodes Scholarship. By being chosen, Park will receive financing to attend the University of Oxford in England. But he risks not being permitted back in the U.S. if he studies there. Dreamers are young adults who were brought to the country illegally as children. When Barack Obama was president, his administration set up a program that permitted them to stay. It is called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA for short. In December, Park completed his studies at Harvard University in Massachusetts. But the excitement of winning the Rhodes Scholarship has been replaced with feelings of uneasiness. President Donald Trump's administration ended the ability of dreamers to travel overseas when it began to discontinue the DACA program in 2017. During the Obama administration, dreamers were permitted limited overseas travel, including studying in other countries. Park and his supporters argue that such travel should still be permitted since federal courts have defended DACA for now. "If I leave, there's a very real possibility that I won't be able to come back. That's the biggest fear for sure," said Park. His family came to the United States from South Korea when he was 7 years old. U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services, which operates DACA, did not answer Associated Press or AP emails seeking comment.
Dreamers got their name because of proposals in the U.S. Congress called the DREAM Act. The proposals, however, did not pass. Still, dreamers have remained protected from possible expulsion. Park told the AP he has had a difficult time talking to his parents about the risks of accepting the Rhodes Scholarship. they cried out in happiness when news of the award came. "I've been avoiding that question," he said days after finishing his studies at Harvard. This was especially meaningful for them. It was like a validation of the sacrifices they've made for me. Nearly 700,000 individuals are currently on DACA, which was created in 2012 and can be renewed every 2 years. To be considered, immigrants must have entered the country by 2007 and been under age 16 when they arrived. The Trump administration approved an order to end DACA in 2017, but federal judges in New York, California, and Washington, D.C. ruled against those efforts last year. Their rulings have kept the program operating. The Trump administration is now seeking a Supreme Court decision.
Past Rhodes Scholars and other Rhodes Trust supporters are volunteering their advice to Park. But Elliot Gerson said the issue is a matter of American law and not anything the Rhodes Trust can resolve alone. Gerson is the British organization's American secretary. "Our hope is for federal action," he added. Christian Ramos is a representative for Define American, an immigrant support organization that helped Park with his Rhodes Scholarship proposal. Ramos said the government should enforce the law as it currently stands and let Jin study in England. Park could reject the scholarship offer, but has decided against that. He wants to remain a voice in the immigration debate and thinks the value of going to Oxford is greater than the risks. "I'm looking forward to having that unstructured time to think about these broader questions of who belongs in America and the value judgments we make about others," he said. Park has been a voice for DACA recipients since he was in high school. In 2015, he founded Higher Dreams, a nonprofit group that helps students without permanent immigration status gain admission to college. With the help of Harvard, Park competed for the Rhodes Scholarship last year. It was part of a larger effort to show how this and other awards ignored DACA recipients. The scholarship was created in 1902 by British businessman and politician Cecil Rhodes. It pays all costs for at least 2 years of study at Oxford.
Like many others in recent years, Park's application for the scholarship was rejected, but the message was received. The Rhodes organization changed its policy effective this year. Park reapplied and was accepted. Gerson said the change shows the organization's efforts to expand who can apply. Legal permanent residents and residents of U.S. territories like Puerto Rico have also been permitted to apply in recent years. At Oxford, Park hopes to study migration and political theory as he decides his future. The molecular and cell biology major has also applied to medical school. But he is still open to possibly working in city government, where he believes he can help change immigration policy no matter who is in the White House. And no matter what happens next, Park still thinks of New York City as his home. For me, I think of Queens, New York, he said. Whatever happens, I'm always going to know that fact. Even if I have to spend the rest of my life convincing the administration or whoever comes next. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In November of 1840, the American people elected William Henry Harrison as their 9th president. Harrison was a retired general and a well-known Indian fighter. Many people considered him a hero for his victory over Native Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Americans elected John Tyler as Harrison's vice president. The two men ran on the campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Harrison was the first president from the Whig Party. Some Whig leaders, including Senators Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, believed they could control the newly elected president. Harrison asked Daniel Webster to edit the speech he planned to give after the swearing-in ceremonies. Webster removed some material from the inaugural speech and suggested other changes. The inauguration took place on March 4, 1841. It was the coldest inaugural day in the nation's history. Harrison spoke on the front steps of the Capitol building. He gave the longest inaugural address of any president. It lasted almost 2 hours. But Harrison did not wear a winter overcoat or hat. He got sick, probably from standing so long outside in the cold. Rest was his best treatment. But the new president was so busy, he had little time to rest. Harrison's health grew worse. Late in March 1841, he developed pneumonia. Doctors did everything they could to cure him, but nothing seemed to help. On April 4th, exactly 1 month after he became president, William Henry Harrison died. Vice President John Tyler was then at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Daniel Webster, the new Secretary of State, sent his son on horseback to tell Tyler of the president's death. The vice president was shocked. He had not even known that Harrison was sick. 2 hours after he received the news, Tyler was on his way to Washington. There was some question about Tyler's official duties. Harrison's death marked the first time that a president had died in office. No one was sure what the Constitution meant when it said that the powers of a deceased president should go to the vice president. Eventually, Tyler, Webster, and other cabinet members decided that Tyler should be president and serve until the next election.
That was a very controversial claim because people said, no, he's not the president. He's an acting president. He's just temporarily filling the office, but he's not president.
Historian Michael Holt taught at the University of Virginia. He says, although not everyone supported John Tyler's claim, he set an important example. He showed how power could transfer peacefully to the vice president after a U.S. president died in office. Tyler was sworn in as the nation's 10th president on April 6, 1841. He was 51 years old. No other man had become president at such an early age. Tyler was a slaveholding Southerner. He was born and grew up in the same part of Virginia as William Henry Harrison. His father was a wealthy landowner and judge who had been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Tyler completed studies at the College of William and Mary and became a lawyer. He entered politics and served in the Virginia State Legislature. Then he was elected a member of Congress and later governor of Virginia. He also served as a member of the United States Senate. Tyler believed strongly in the rights of the states. As a congressman and a senator, he had voted against every attempt to give more power to the federal government. In fact, historian Michael Holt says that in many ways, Tyler was more like a member of the Democrats, the opposing party at the time.
He favored the typical position of Democrats on what we could call domestic policy, which is that government is best which governs least. The less federal domestic policy you have trying to generate economic growth or improve society or whatever, the better.
In comparison, many Whig Party members firmly supported the ideas of a national bank, a protective tax on imports, and federal spending to improve transportation in the states. Tyler was just as firmly against these ideas. At the same time, many Democrats did not like the president either.
Most Democrats regarded him as a traitor who had jumped from the Jackson Party and joined the Whigs, however temporarily.
Michael Holt says even Tyler's appearance made him seem difficult and unpleasant.
You look at this guy and he's sort of aesthetically thin and with sunken cheeks and a long pointed nose. He just looks like he's unhappy with the world.
President Tyler quickly became even more unpopular over the issue of a new national bank. He wanted to establish such a bank in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The national bank could open offices in a state, but only if the state approved. Tyler's proposal was not the kind of bank most Whigs in Congress supported. They wanted no limits of any kind on the power of a national bank to open offices anywhere in the country. Whigs in Congress suggested a compromise. Bank offices would be permitted in any state where the state legislature did not immediately refuse permission. But President Tyler vetoed the compromise. He sent the bank bill back to Congress. The congressman wrote another bill. They said it was exactly what the president wanted. But the president did not agree. He said the states must have the right to approve or reject bank offices. He said this second bill would also be vetoed unless changes were made in it. The changes were not made, and Tyler did as he said he would do. He vetoed it. The decision created a crisis in the cabinet. All the president's advisors but one, Daniel Webster, resigned. Michael Holt says that several days later, most cabinet members and a large group of other Whig congressmen voted to expel Tyler from the party.
They read this paper saying he's no Whig. Don't blame us for all of his vetoes.
Harrison appointed a new cabinet of Whigs he hoped would be more friendly to him, but after a while, they too resigned. Michael Holt says Tyler made more changes in his cabinet than any other U.S. president. President Tyler struggled with his party over other issues. One was about import taxes. 2 years into Tyler's presidency, the government found itself short of money. It was spending more than it had. Congress decided that import taxes should be raised, some even higher than 20%. But President Tyler vetoed the bill. He said it was wrong to raise the tax so high and, at the same time, continue to give the states money from land sales. He said the federal government itself needed the land sale money. Michael Holt says once again the Whigs were angry. Their party controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, but they could not reach their goals.
The Whigs were elected with this agenda that they wanted Congress to pass, that they had promised would rescue the country from a very serious depression. And this included a new national bank, higher tariffs, distribution of federal revenues from public land sales.
President Tyler, he adds, frustrated the entire Whig legislative program. It was clear the Whigs would not nominate him for the next election, so Tyler turned his attention to the Democrats. He hoped they would ask him to be their presidential candidate in 1844. Tyler began appointing Democratic advisors to his cabinet, and he gave his support to one of the Democrats' causes, making Texas a state in the Union. Texas was an independent nation at the time. Some Americans wanted to bring Texas into the United States to further expand the country. But others were afraid that the territory would permit slavery. They wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler had the opposite fear. Michael Holt explains that Tyler was afraid that Texas would remain an independent republic and abolish slavery there.
He and other Southerners thought that that was a terrible idea. But he also believed that this is what's going to put him in the history books, that he's going to be responsible for adding this enormous Republic of Texas, although it wasn't quite as big as what they claimed, to the United States.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.